From Unconsciousness to Consciousness. Number 12. An Osho talk given spontaneously to an international audience in the USA. Jews, Christians, Hindus, Jainas, Mohammedans. They put their hope in a future life. But I don't see the same hope among people around you. Why is it so?
There are three ways to live. Only one is authentic. The two are pseudo. First, let me explain you the pseudo ways. Then it will be easier to understand the right way. These are the two pseudo ways most of the people have lived and are living. First is the yesterday, the past. The second is the tomorrow, the future. Both are really ways of deceiving yourself. The yesterday is no more. And the tomorrow has not come yet. The yesterday cannot be lived. Yes, only in imagination, but not truly. It is dead. There is no way to make it alive again. You cannot move in time backwards. That which is gone forever. But millions of people, 99.9% people, have chosen to live either in the yesterday or in the tomorrow. The tomorrow is not there and is not going to be ever there. It never comes by its very nature. It is always coming, 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 but it never comes. It is only a hope which is not going to be fulfilled. But hope is the most ancient psychological drug. First, let us look into the yesterdays, because at least they have been there. They cannot be again. But they had been there. Hindus have the most deliberate philosophy about the life of yesterdays, because that is the most philosophical religion out of all the religions. Hindus have divided time into four ages. The first is called Satyuga, the age of truth. That was in the very beginning of time. No historical record exists about it. No other kind of evidence exists about it. In fact, everything that exists gives evidence against it. Because the man like Krishna, whom Hindus worship as the descendants of God in all his aspects, in his totality. Even this man is not a man of truth. He lies. He is a politician. He changes very easily. He promises and goes against the promise. And this is their idea of God in his perfection. And to lie to Krishna is so easy that even your third-class politicians, of course they are all third-class, I should not use third-class, because there is no other class of politicians. Even they feel ashamed to lie, and when they are caught, they feel that they have acted not in good faith, not so with Krishna. He is a perfect politician. He is not a perfect God, but a perfect politician. Lying is his business. Deception is his whole game. And this age Hindus call the age of truth. And if this is the situation of their greatest man, what about the ordinary masses? There has never been such a time as the age of truth, where everybody was authentic, honest, true to himself and to existence. But Hindus are a very old religion. So you have to understand this psychological phenomenon. The child has no past. He has only future. The old man has no future, but only past. So all the old religions are past-oriented. They live in their yesterdays, naturally. The new religions live in the future. They don't have any past to fall upon. They have to project a future. The latest religion, communism. Remember, I count communism with all the other religions because it fulfills every criterion of being a religion. It asks you to be faithful to the dogma. It asks you to believe in the trinity of Karl Marx, Friedrich Engels, Lenin. It demands to believe in the absolute truth of Das Kapital, the book that Marx wrote. No doubt is allowed. No argument is possible with Marx. The religion has come to its completion. Now nothing is going to be added. But this is so with all the new religions. Mohammedanism is only 1400 years old. Sikhism, 500 years old. Christianity, 2000 years old. To the Indian mind, 2000 years mean nothing. Hinduism is at least 10,000 years old. That is the very dogmatic scientific attitude to the Hindu himself. He calls his religion Sanatan Dharma. It means eternal religion. There is no question of time. It has always been there. So you cannot count in years or even in light years. You will be surprised to know that Hinduism is not the name given by Hindus themselves. They call their religion Sanatan Dharma, the eternal religion. Hinduism is given by the enemies of Hindus. But it happens many times that you become known by the name that the enemies give to you, and slowly you adopt it. It was given by people who went on conquering India for almost 3,000 years. On the frontier, there is one of the most beautiful and biggest river of the world, Sindhu. The first conquerors were Hunas, a very barbarous community, very violent. Almost cannibals. I say almost because few of them still were eating other human beings. When Hunas 3,000 years before conquered India, in their alphabet there is no word, no letter equivalent to S. The closest is H. So they called Sindhu, the river, Hindu River. There was no other way because they had no S in their alphabet. So the closest word has to be used. Sindhu became Hindu. And the people who lived beyond Hindu River, they called Hindus. All the words about India are derived from that time. When Greeks came, they had no equivalent to H. The closest was I. So they called Sindhu Indu, which later on became Indus. And from Indus is India. Strangely, they all came from the river Sindhu. Now, the whole West knows the country as India. The name is given by the Westerners. Or as Hindu, the name is given by Hunas and Mohammedans. Nobody calls it Aryavart. That is the name of the country of the people who lived there. The country of the Aryans, and their religion was called Sanatan Dharma. It is certainly far more ancient than 10,000 years. But there is no proof that there has ever been an age of truth, that is imagination. That is the old man, the old country, the old religion. It cannot project in the future, in the future is only death. The future is dark. It can only glorify the past. So the first age, the best, the golden age is Satyuga, the age of truth. You will be also surprised. Charles Darwin was not acquainted with the idea. When he started to work on the theory of evolution, it would have been of great help if he was aware of the Hindu concept of involution, not evolution. Man has been falling down, not growing up. There is no evolution, because evolution means future. What evolution is there for a dying man, for an old man? Of course, for a child, there is evolution. But for the old man, everything is shrinking, drowning in darkness. So before the word evolution ever became prominent in the world of thought, Hindus have already made another word, just the opposite of it, very significant, involution. Things are going down every day. Second stage they call Treta Yuga. Treta only means the third. Because what I have called the first stage, Satyuga, they call it the fourth stage, the highest. Because if you call it first, then the second will be evolution, then the third will be evolution, then the fourth will be evolution. Hindus are very philosophical minded. They have called the first the fourth, second the third the second, fourth the first, the lowest. Satyuga is the best, the golden age, when everything is just as it should be. Nothing can be improved upon it. There is no crime. There is no immorality. There is no death. There is no sickness, there is no poverty. You name anything bad and it is not there. They also call it the fourth stage because it is absolutely balanced. just like a table with four legs, is completely balanced. No possibility of falling from it. People don't lock their doors, they don't have locks, because nobody steals. That's what they are projecting. It is not true. But if you hurt anybody's imagination on which he is living, which is his only joy, they become angry. When I started telling them that there were not locks, because locks need a certain technology to develop, there was no technology to make a lock. And people were so poor, there was nothing to be stolen from them. Because we know even Rama's wife, one of other Hindu incarnation of God, is stolen. So if even the incarnation of God's wife is stolen, what about other people's wives? And we know about Krishna, who stole 16,000 wives from other people. They were wives, mothers, they were taken away from their husbands, their children, forcibly. And you call this Satyug? We know, I have told you, Parasuram murdered his own mother. And you said there was no crime. And Parasuram is one of the incarnations of God. And not only that, he murdered his own mother, because his father had ordered. The father must have been like an ordinary, mediocre husband who is always suspicious. Perhaps he was getting old and impotent. The wife was young and beautiful, and he was suspicious. And there was every reason to be suspicious too. Because Hindu scriptures themselves describe that even gods, remember, for Hindus there is not only one god. There are 33 million gods. Gods become interested in women of the earth because they get tired with plastic beauty. In heaven there is plastic beauty. Those girls, they never grow old. They don't perspire. They remain just the same always, and they are immensely beautiful. But something is inhuman about them. You can have a plastic girl, absolutely beautiful. Even arrangements can be made that she breathes. Arrangements can be made, she smiles, says hello. At least till the battery runs out, she kisses you, she says, I love you. Everything can be recorded, and that's how it is, recorded. Just the battery is running for 70 years. That's the only thing. But we can make batteries, even better batteries, which can run 100 years, 200 years. Only once in a while, perhaps you may have go to the repair shop, change the battery or something. Those girls in heaven are plastic. So naturally, people must be getting bored. You may not have thought about it that you can be bored by beauty too. How long you can see a beautiful face? And those gods are living eternally with those girls, the same faces. They must be utterly bored. Anything, if can be said with certainty about heaven, that is, it must be boring. Utterly boring. And not only of one religion, of all religions, I will discuss about each. Their religions are bound to be boring. To keep you unbored, to keep you excited and alive, change is needed. Nothing changes there. Everything is permanent. So gods come in disguise and rape women on the earth. Of course, they are gods. It seems all the gods of all the religions are rapists. And if they can be caught, they should be either punished or cured. So gods used to come in Hindu Puranas, that is their ancient stories. And the rishis, the sages, of course, had the lion's share. Greater the sage, the more beautiful woman he could get. Hindu sages of the past were not bachelors. They were not Catholics. They were not Jains. They were not Buddhists. This idea of remaining bachelors, celibate, is a very new addition. Hindu sages, they were far, far away from this idea. This idea has not occurred yet. And because somebody was a sage, wise, well-known, respected, naturally, he will get the best, the most beautiful woman of the society. Even kings will offer their daughters to them. So Parashuram's father was a great sage. He may have got a most beautiful woman. And he was suspicious. And these gods used to come in disguise. Gods can do any kind of miracle. Just the other day I have received a Christian woman's angry letter to me. that do you understand you are here in a Christian country and you are saying such dangerous things that Holy Ghost was a rapist and Holy Ghost is part of God. It makes God a rapist. And it was not a rape with Virgin Mary, it was a miracle, she writes. Yes. It was a miracle to deceive that poor girl. It must have been a miracle. Perhaps the Holy Ghost has come as Joseph. And Mary must have thought, he is my husband. And that's the way Hindu gods have been doing. They come, the sage has gone, because the sage has to go early in the morning, 3 o'clock, to the Ganges to take his bath and do a long prayer and ritual and everything by before sunrise. So at 3 o'clock he goes to the Ganges, and at 3 o'clock the god comes. Disguised as his husband. And the poor woman cannot say even no. She cannot say that I have a headache today. That is not allowed in Hinduism. A Hindu woman has to worship his husband as a god. His order is order. It has to be fulfilled. No question of disobedience. So Parasuram's father must have been suspicious, and he may have some grounds for it. He told Parasuram, you go and cut the head of your mother, bring your mother's head before me. And Parasuram went and cut the mother's head. Obedience to father. And then begins his history of violence. His father ordered him that destroy the whole warrior race from the earth, because there was a conflict between the Brahmins and the warriors, Brahmins and Kshatriyas, a conflict which always is there, that who is to be on top? The intellectual, the scientist, the Brahmin, the wise man, the sage, or the politician, the soldier, the general, who is? The conflict still continues. It must have been there. Parasuram was ordered to destroy all the warriors once for all. It is said, the story must be exaggerated, but some truth must be there to exaggerate it. It is said for 36 times he destroyed all the warriors from the earth. But there was one difficulty, and that was his father has not said to destroy the women of the warriors. The women were there. And Hinduism allows that a woman can go to a sage and ask to be made pregnant by him, and the sage cannot refuse it. That is his religious duty. So all those women must be going to the sages, and India is full of sages, and at that time must have been more full. So they were getting pregnant again, and there were warriors again. 36 times by the time Parasuram became very old and was not able to kill anymore, he has done as much violence as one man can do. And now these people say there was no violence. And their own books describe nothing but violence. In Mahabharata, the great Indian war, that is the meaning of Mahabharata. It must have happened somewhere 5 to 7,000 years before, or perhaps 10,000 years. It certainly happened. There are evidences. And it destroyed the whole backbone of the country forever. It was certainly a great world war. Almost all the known nations participated in it. It was a family war in a way. Cousin brothers were quarreling for the kingdom. And they were brothers. And all their relatives had to divide. Some relatives with one party, some relatives with another party. And they were all related. And they were so important that all other smaller nations participated in the war, either from this side or from that side. And it killed millions of people. It seems by the description in Mahabharata that perhaps they had come to know something similar, nuclear weapons. Perhaps. Because the destruction is so vast, so immense. That by the time the war was over and one party, the Pandavas, have won it, they saw it was worthless to win it, because now on whom to rule? There were only corpses and corpses all over the country. They became so frustrated that they renounced the world and went to the Himalayas. It was not worth this victory. What kind of victory this was? And they have lost all their people, either from the other side, they were their friends, their relatives. On their side also, they were their friends, their relatives, and other parties' friends and relatives. And they have destroyed them all. Yes, they are victorious, but over whom? Over these corpses. That's what will happen if a third world war happens. One who wins over will weep and cry. The one who dies and is finished, has lost the war, maybe in a better position, at least he has not to see the ugliness of victory. You are victorious, but there was nobody even to clap your victory. And then Pandavas realize it was absolutely worthless. We should not have fought. We should have given the kingdom to the other party. At least people would have lived. And now we are going to the Himalayas. We could have gone before. Now we are going in utter frustration, in deep despair and anguish. Then we would have gone rejoicing. But it is not true that there was not violence, there was not war, that there was not a stealing. It is not true. But Hindus look at Satyoga as the golden age. And then began the fall. Treta Yuga. Has only three legs. The Satyuga had four, like a table with four legs. Now it is a tripod with three legs, not so balanced. It can topple over very easily. It is crippled. One essential part of humanity is lost. If you want to understand it psychologically, the Hindu psychology explains it in the Satyuga. There was the collective unconscious mind, the subconscious mind, the conscious mind, and the superconscious mind. And that superconscious mind was in power. All the three lower minds followed it. These are the four legs. In Treta Yuga, Treta means three, the third. The English word third comes from the same root as treta, three. That has become three. The superconscious disappears, the best part in man. Now there was conscious, subconscious, unconscious. Still things were good. Not that good. At that time they were just divine. Now they were human, but good. Tolerantly good. But few things started happening which were not good. It is in the Treta that Hindus think Jainism, Buddhism, this type of religions arose. Because to them, these religions are very destructive. They destroyed the belief in God, they destroyed their very foundation. They destroyed the belief in the Vedas as created by God. They started joking and laughing about Vedas, criticizing, and started asking for proof. They started creating doubt. Doubt enters into humanity. Faith disappears. And doubt to the faithful is one of the greatest diseases. It destroys his belief. So Jainas and Buddhas are called atheists by Hindus. They are not accepted as theists or religious people. No. They are the cause of destroying the religion. But still, although they denied God, they denied Vedas, they valued immensely the qualities of truth, non-violence, non-stealing, non-possessiveness. So things went down, but still there was something valuable. Then that age also disappeared. Man fell still more. Then comes Dwapar. Dwapar means the second. Dwa is exactly twa, two. The word has the same root. English has almost 30% roots from Sanskrit. It is a Sanskrit-oriented language. So is German, so is Swedish, so is French, so is Italian, so is Russian. All European languages have from 30% to 70% Sanskrit roots. In Dwapar, only two legs remained. Man became really sick. Now the table has lost two legs, and only on two legs, how can you put it balanced? It became almost impossible to have balance. In Dwapar, man lives subconsciously. The conscious mind has disappeared. Now he lives instinctively. He does not know why he is doing it, why this desire is in him, why a certain thing makes him happy or unhappy. But he goes on groping in the dark. But the dark is still not too thick. A little light, hence subconscious, a candle light perhaps in the dark night. But most of it is covered with darkness. Just a little light that you call your intelligence, rationality, but just a little light which can be gone within a second. Just a blow of wind and it is gone. Somebody hits you and your intelligence is gone and you are completely behaving like an animal. Somebody walks on your feet and that's enough. Your intelligence is gone. And you are holding the man by the neck to kill him. So your intelligence is just a flickering light. At the mercy of any accident, it can go. And then comes the last Kali Yuga, the age of darkness, in which we are living now. According to Hindus, this is the most fallen stage. Man is absolutely unconscious, drunk, insane. There is no future. There will be more and more darkness. All the best has passed. So old religions look towards the yesterdays. Those yesterdays were not there really. They had never happened. They are projected on the screen of yesterdays by human mind because the human mind cannot live unless he feels something beautiful, ecstatic, blissful. How he can live? And he is so empty that he finds it easy to fill that emptiness with a long, beautiful past. That is about the old countries and old religions. Jainas have the same status, the past. Future holds no hope. In this world, future holds hope for them in the other world after life, in heaven, in paradise, but not here. Here everything is finished. That's the reason why countries like India and China, oldest civilizations in the world, greatest civilizations in the world, ancient, most cultured civilizations in the world, have remained in suffering because they accepted that nothing better can be possible here. Only after death. So past, clinging to the past, that is a treasure. keep your eyes focused on the past and prepare for the future in the other life, not in this life. This life holds no hope. For the new religions, there is no past. To spread their wings of imagination and dreaming, they have only future, and that future is in the other world. Or a communism type religion has it here, but not today. Somewhere tomorrow, which is always hanging there like the horizon. But more you come closer to it, farther away it goes on moving. In 1917, Lenin was absolutely certain that within 10 years we will achieve the utopia. More than 60 years have passed. The utopia is farther away than it was in 1917. Now nobody talks about the utopia. No communist leader in Russia talks about it, because they know that it is not going to happen. It was just a hope that you drugged people with. Hence I call it the ancient most drug. Far more dangerous than any LSD, marijuana, or anything that science is going to discover. Hope for the future. And that is beyond the life. So there is no way to find out whether it happens or not. People go on dying. Nobody gives any sign from the other source, any indication that what you were hoping is really here. At least one person in millions and millions of people, and such beautiful people have died, a Buddha, a Jesus, a Muhammad, a Krishna. Can't they make any effort in some way to give a little indication? And now many scientists have died. Einstein, people of immense intelligence, they can find some way to signal, to give us an indication that keep courage. We have arrived safe. At least this much telegram will do. But in millions of years, not a single indication from the other source. So it is very beautiful for the priest that no indication from the other soul, otherwise there will be immediate trouble. He can go on exploiting you, because after death, what happens? Nothing can be said about it. So whatsoever he says, on the authority of the other priests, other old scriptures, that is the only thing. You have to believe in it. And you have to believe, because otherwise you feel ungrounded, uprooted. Then there is only death. Life you have never known. And death is coming every moment closer. Nobody knows whether he will be tomorrow here or not. Death is going to happen someday or other. And it is going to be some tomorrow. For you, for me, for somebody else, millions of people are dying every day. Before death, they have not thought about that they are going to die. Project. Otherwise, your life is so dull, so boring, so unfulfilled. Not a single flower has blossomed on you. No fruitfulness. You cannot feel anything worthwhile in you. That is the reason why all the religions go on giving hope, and all the so-called religious people live on hope. Hope is the opium. But very psychological. It is natural that in my commune you will not find anybody bothering about future, bothering about what happens after death. Because so much is happening right now, who cares about death? So much joy and so much peace and so much silence is available right now. Who has time to think about tomorrow? That tomorrow will take care of itself. We are so busy living here and now. That's why you don't see my people talking about the past or the future. They don't bother about the past. If it was not no harm to us, if all these people had not happened at all, if all these history books are just inventions and fictions, so what? If there has been no past, no yesterday, so what? It does not take anything from us. We are not living on it. We are not in any way rooted in it. We are free of it. If it all disappears, so far so good. It carries no meaning for us. And why we should be bothered about future? If you know the art of living, and that's what I call religion, real, authentic religion, the art of living. If you know the art of living, and it consists of small things, not of big, great commandments, very small things, just sipping your tea joyfully, meditatively, tasting each sip as if this is the last sip, perhaps you may not be able again to hold the cup in your hands. There is no guarantee. When you are meeting a friend, meet. Who knows? You may not be meeting again. Then you will repent. Then that unfulfilled past will haunt you, that you wanted to say something and you could not say. There are people who want to say to somebody, I love you, and they are for years waiting and have not said it. And the person one day may die, and then they will cry and weep, and they will say, I wanted to say to the person, I love you, I could not even say that. My people are living so fully that there is no space for any tomorrow, for any yesterday. And only fools bother about death. In fact, only people who don't know how to live bother about death. They are afraid. They know they have missed the train of life. Now only death is there. Now what is death? What happens after death? They are thinking to catch the train after death. Here they have missed. These fools who can miss here, do you think will be able to catch the train after death? While they were living, fully alive, and they missed the train, when they are dead, I don't think they will be able to catch the train. But if you are living fully, joyously, there is no reason at all to think of the future. It does not arise at all in your being. And your contentment, moment to moment, goes on making you more and more fulfilled. So fulfilled that you could not have imagined, dreamt of it. With this fulfillment, if death comes, you will live that death moment too, with joy and ecstasy. Because it will be opening a new door, a new possibility. You will be thrilled. It will be an adventure and a challenge. And you will not be afraid of death, because what death can take from you, what death can disturb, what death can stop. But a person who has not lived, he is afraid of death and trembling. An ancient story. Yayati, a famous Indian king, became 100 years old. It was enough, more than enough. He had hundreds of wives, 100 sons. His death came. The story is immensely significant. Yayati, seeing death, said, "What? So soon? So many things are incomplete. I have not done this, I have not done that, I have done only half a part, something I have just begun, and many things I have not even started. What? Is this the time to come? I need 100 years more at least. Be kind enough." Death said, "I have no problem. You do one thing, but I have to take someone." Yes. The bureaucracy. If you are not going, then I will take somebody else and fill the file and the forms and be finished. But somebody I have to take. You have 100 sons. Ask anybody of them. Give one of your son, and I am ready to trade for it. I give you 100 years more, you give me one son. And Yayati looked at his sons. Some were 70 years old, some were 65, 68, 60, 50. The youngest was 20. The youngest son stood up. All others started looking at each other. Naturally, and when you have not completed your living in 100 years, how I can complete my living in 70 years? And why I should die for you? I have yet 30 years left for me. And the man who was 50, he said, "I have lived only half my life, and if you are unsatisfied, what about me?" They all looked at each other. They have so many times told to the father that if there is a need, we are ready to die for you, but when the need comes, then it is very difficult. The youngest, the most innocent, who has no experience, stood up and told to death that, "I am ready. You can take me." Even death felt sorry for the boy, because all these 99 older sons, whose death is not far away anyway, they are not willing. And this young boy, even death said to the son that, "It is not right for you, you are too young. And can't you see no one from your other brothers has stood up? Your father does not want to die at the age of 100. The boy laughed and he said, "That's why I am ready. If at the age of 100, he's begging, what is the point? That's why I am ready, because I can see at my 99 brothers. If they have not been able to taste life in 70 years, 65 years, 60 years, 50 years, how I'm going to manage? At least I have lived 20 years, and I have really lived. And it has been such a fulfillment. that I don't think that any more time is needed. I have tasted the cup of life. Perhaps they have forgotten when they were young. I am fresh. I can still feel the taste on my tongue of youthfulness, life. You can take me without feeling sad for me. I am not sad. In fact, I am very much thrilled by the very adventure. Life I have known, it was beautiful. Let me know death too. And if life is so beautiful, how can death be anything else? Because death is the crescendo of life, the very peak of life. It is not the end. It is the highest omega point. Don't waste time. I am so excited to know death, to feel death, to taste it. The story is so significant. The boy was taken away. Death absolutely certain that this is not the type of person who dies ever. He cannot die. Death is impossible for him. He is ready to live death. Then how you can die? Death happens only to cowards. To those who have not tasted life, whose cup is empty. Death does not happen to those whose cup is overflowing. Yes, there is a tremendous opening. But it is not death. It is a door that opens to the beyond, to the unknown, to the unexplored, uncharted. Hundred years again passed and death came back. And Yayati said, what? 100 years have passed, but I am still where I was. Death said, you will be the same, but I will give you a chance. Let it be an example to all. Just give me another of your son. And after 100 years, I will come back. This happens for 1,000 years continuously. The last time the death comes, Hiyayati says, I am still at the same point, but I am ready to go. Because one thing I have understood, I don't know how to live and how long I can postpone and how long I can go on begging you. And I am tired. utterly tired. 1,000 years of sheer wastage. I have not tasted a single moment. So what is the point now? And anyway, any time, whenever I will have to go, things will be incomplete. Many things will be done half the way. Many things will be just started. Many things not even started, but only in the idea. I have seen this in these 1,000 years. I am jealous of my those sons who had the courage to go with you. I am jealous. They proved courage, intelligence. Now I understand. They were slapping on my face each time one of my son was taken. They were saying, "You are a fool. You don't know how to live, and you are postponing death. And you will remain afraid of death till you start living. But I don't know how to live, so it is better to die. Let others live." The death said to Yayati, "This is the first sign of intelligence in you. And not only you are jealous of your sons that I have taken, even I have been jealous. They were rare, unique, really alive people. I have not been able to destroy them. They have moved from life to more life. They have moved from life to abundant life. And that's what I am teaching here. Live so totally that you transform even that phenomena of death into a door, a new opening for more abundant life. Yes, that life is waiting, but only for those who know how to experience it, how to live it. And this is the time. Only today is the time. Neither yesterday nor tomorrow is the time to live life. Only today. This moment. Here and now is the time to taste life, then there is no death. Yes, a kind of death will happen. Your body and you will be separated. But you will be not dying, you will be expanding. You will be throwing away the bondage of your body, the imprisonment of your body, and you will be coming in contact with the unlimited, the unbounded, the universal. That universal life is godliness.